The last 3 weeks, I've been in Jerusalem, Budapest, Vienna, Zurich, Geneva, Paris, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, and Washington.
How do you know?
That's good. I've got a schedule in my head, which tells me if it's Tuesday, I'm in Washington.
What all are you doing?
Well, I'm on now. I'm on a promotional tour for my book, but earlier I was on a basic research tour, which I do every year. I've been a foreign correspondent for a great many years, and although I'm no longer on a foreign beat, I'm on a general beat. I like to keep my notebooks green and up to date, and change and new sources come in. And so I want to keep my source books up to date. There's a new government in Israel. They're not new to me because Shimon Peres is an old friend, as is Yitzhak Shamir. But I like to see what's going on and who shifts in the Foreign Office and the Defense Department. These things go on. And sometimes even a very small shift is terribly important. And, you know, a new secretary could be a very important new source.
I want to ask you some things, mostly about your life and about some of the things you did at the CBS, some of the incidents that occurred over your long career that you describe in America Inside Out. First of all, as you wrote the book, you have a lot of material. Well, one thing I like very much is the way that you interspersed a lot of the personal things about your life with these global incidents that occurred as you worked as a news correspondent.
That's really why I call it a personal history. I'm not an historian, I'm a student of history. And somebody asked me the other day to give him a very simple explanation of this book, America Inside Out. And I said, well, basically, it's a biography of Uncle Sam by his loving nephew, David Schoenbrunn. And my life has been so interspersed with the life of my nation that I thought I would write them together. And it wasn't easy. It was very difficult to work it out, and I'm glad to hear you say that you thought it was successful.
Yes, I enjoy that very much, because it helps to put in perspective your role as a newsperson and the role that you play in covering these events. I think that's very... Well, William L. Shirer did that, too, with his memoir. I can't remember the title of it.
20th Century Journey.
No, the new one.
Nightmare Years.
The Nightmare Years. And I just had him in a while ago, too, and I forgot the title. But he did much the same thing and interspersed his personal life.
Not really. Bill Shirer, an old friend of mine, worked with me at CBS, spent most of his career and earned his fame justifiably, for he's a wonderful reporter and writer, in Germany, whereas I've really roamed the entire world.
You did that. Well, let's go back. Let's go back to 1939. You were a school teacher, and you began working at what may have been a tedious job at CBS News, monitoring shortwave radio broadcasts.
That was one of the great CBS initiatives, you know. CBS has been, from the start, the greatest news organization, not only because it had great broadcasters, it had great editors. And at the time, the greatest of them all was Paul White. And Paul kept imagining things that he could do to improve the knowledge of his own broadcasters. And so he created a monitoring station, which was a very powerful station that could listen in to broadcasts from Radio Berlin and Radio Madrid, Radio Paris, Radio Rome. And he hired a number of people who could speak German, French, Spanish, Italian. And we would listen to these broadcasts and type them up in English. And when we finished, we'd cut snippets out and send it to the great broadcasters, William Shirer, Ed Morrow, Elmer Davis, the greatest of them all, and they would extract bits of information from the things that we did. It wasn't really easy working on an old, stiff Underwood typewriter, listening to a French or a German broadcast and typing it up in English, but we learned how to do it. And that was my beginnings with CBS. I really wasn't an employee of CBS. I worked only for the monitoring station. But it was tremendous training, and of course I revered men like Elmer Davis, Bill Shirer, and the others, and I said, by God, one day I'm going to be on the CBS team.
You weren't wrong either. One thing that helped to lead to your job at CBS a number of years later was an article that you wrote that turned out to be a series of articles for the now-defunct newspaper called PM.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, that was really fascinating. You see, I was working at this monitoring station, and I would listen to the ravings and rantings of Joseph Paul Goebbels, the propaganda minister of Adolf Hitler. And then I'd go home, take a long subway ride, and I would read the New York Daily News. And one night, reading the Daily News, it seemed to me tremendously familiar, as though I knew the editorial. But of course I knew I didn't. Not possible. It was just published. So when I came back to work the other day, next day, I talked to a cousin of mine, a German, Dr. Henry Cassira, and I said, "Hey, Henry, look at this. Sound familiar?" And he read the editorial, and he said, "Well, by God, that was a speech that Goebbels made 3 days ago." And I said, "Is somebody sneaking Nazi propaganda into one of the world's greatest newspapers, the New York Daily News?" We got suspicious. So we took all of our scripts, and we rushed down to the New York Public Library, where they have a complete list of all the newspapers. And we were smart little kids because we knew that the Daily News was part of a chain of three great newspapers. The Chicago Tribune, cousin, Colonel McCormick owned it, cousin of Captain Joe Patterson, and the Washington Times Herald, Sissy Patterson. And we read the editorials of these three newspapers against the scripts that we had typed up from Radio Berlin. And we found a correlation of really more than 70%. We were astonished. There no longer was any doubt in our minds. Somebody was slipping Nazi propaganda into three great American newspapers. We didn't know quite what to do with it. So I sat down, took all the information, wrote up an article saying there's an Axis press in America, and we decided the only paper that might have the guts enough to do it would be PM. PM was then run by one of America's greatest editors, Ralph Ingersoll, who had been the editorial director of Life magazine, had quit to start this noble experiment, a newspaper without advertising. And, of course, it didn't last very long. It had to go out of business. It couldn't earn enough money. But we took it down to Ralph Ingersoll and showed it to him, and he was completely captivated by it. And he ran it. He ran it as a series. He gave us each a check. I'm talking about, you know, 1939, 1940. We got a fortune, $1,000 apiece. Now, that's not much today, but believe me, in those days, today it's not a bad...
It would be pretty good for a newspaper article today, actually.
Well, that really started my whole career, because not long later, I got a call from the dean of my college, Dean Gottschalk at CCNY, who said, "You're going to be getting a telephone call from a man named Donovan who wants to talk to you. You talk to him. He's an important man." I had no idea who this fellow was. He called me up and invited me down to his office, a very swank Wall Street office. And later I discovered that he was Wild Bill Donovan, the great hero of World War I and one of America's leading Wall Street lawyers, a Republican. But he was working for Frank Roosevelt. And I'll tell you what he was working on. He told it to me. He said, "You know, we've been living in isolation so long that we don't know a darn thing about the outside world. And war clouds are on the horizon. We're going to be in war just as sure as come tomorrow. And I've got to get together a bunch of young Americans who know something about the outside world, because at the moment we're caught short." Now, he said, "I called the dean of your college. He gave me a list of young fellows. You're one of them. Apparently you speak three or four European languages. You're from a European family. You know Europe. And I'd like to hire a guy like you." And I said, "To do what, sir?" "Well, to be a spy," he said. I laughed, and I said, "Not me." He said, "What do you mean? You got any ethical or moral convictions against it?" I said, "Oh, no, I'll serve my country in any way I can. But I'd make a lousy spy, because I got a big mouth and a short fuse, and they'd catch me pretty fast." And Donovan laughed. He said, "Well, at least you know yourself, and you're frank and honest. I like that. I think maybe I'll have another job for you. I'll call you some other time." A couple of months later, he called me up. He said, "We're starting a new organization. Going to be called the Voice of America. I'd like you to be one of those voices of America, speaking in French to the French people," who by then had been defeated by the Nazis. And he said, "Telling them that America is coming into this war, that we're big and we're strong and we're going to liberate them, and telling them what a great country we are, to build up their morale, and we're going to need their friendship one day." And that's how I began my broadcasting career. For the first 18 months of my broadcasting career, I didn't speak a word of English.
Mm-hmm. Well, your days at The Voice didn't last too long, because you were inducted into the Army. But in a way, I guess you ultimately did work for Wild Bill Donovan again as a man in the Army, isn't it?
Well, I was trained at the OWI to go to Algiers to join General Eisenhower's staff. Now, when I was inducted, the OWI was furious. They'd wasted all that training, and they tried to convince me to get an exemption from President Roosevelt, which I could have gotten. And I said, oh, no, I'm not going to live the rest of my life being exempted by the President of the United States. I said, I've been telling my fellow Americans that we have got to get into this thing and fight Hitler. And if I say that, I'd better be ready to do that. So I'm going into the Army anyway. Well, I went in. I had a hilarious time at Fort Dix. Simply awful. It was like a bad TV comedy series. And then they sent me to a secret intelligence camp in Camp Ritchie in the Blue Ridge Mountains to train to parachute into France. And it was there that a telegram came in signed by General Eisenhower saying, send Private David Schoenbrunn, 32904-876, to my headquarters immediately. And I begged them not to. I said, look, in 2 weeks I'm getting my lieutenant's bars. And they said, hey, when you get a telegram from General Eisenhower, you go. So they sent me, and then I discovered what happened. My old buddies at the Voice of America and the OWI, who had trained me and who were angry about my going to the Army, had gone to Eisenhower's senior aide and told him the story, and he said, oh, fine. And he sent the telegram in Eisenhower's name. They yanked me out and sent me over to Algiers in exactly the same job. There's only one difference. I went as a private instead of a highly paid civilian.
Well, ultimately, you became a four-star sergeant.
That's right.
As you point out.
Well, that was another extraordinary experience. They told me that I was to go into Italy and then into the invasion of France as, presumably, a Stars and Stripes and Army radio correspondent. But I had a secret intelligence mission. They knew there was going to be trouble between the American Army and the French Army on its border for all kinds of reasons, one being the French Army was very poor, we were very rich, and they kept stealing all of our equipment, which they needed very badly. And a lot of Americans didn't like the French. A lot of French didn't like the Americans. And they wanted to find out if any officer of importance was impeding the war effort. And they wanted me to report back to General Walter Beadle Smith and name this guy and get him transferred. And I first refused flatly to do it. I said, no, I'm not going to spy on my buddies in the Army. And they said, no, David, we don't want you to be a sneak. We're trying to win the war. And we promise you, David, that nobody you name is going to get a mark on his service record. We're just going to quietly transfer them to another front where they can't do any damage. And that promise was given to me by General Smith, an honorable man. I believed him, and so I accepted that mission. But in order to accomplish that mission, I had to be freewheeling. I had to move back and forth from division to division, from the American front to the French front, and I knew that the military police were going to get in my way constantly. So they gave me an incredible letter. By then I was a sergeant. And it said, to all ranks, be it known that Sergeant David Schoenbrunn, 32904-876, is on a special mission for this headquarters, and cooperation of all ranks is required. Signed, Dwight David Eisenhower. Well, somebody found out about that and dubbed me a four-star sergeant. In fact, I was, because in the Army, you know, there's a pecking order. A captain can peck a lieutenant, and a colonel can peck a captain, but nobody could peck me but General Eisenhower.
Do you still have that letter?
No, they took it back. They took it away from me.
That would be a keepsake. Well, we're going to have to jump ahead a little bit. Actually, during this period, you began to do some CBS broadcasting, didn't
you?
Yes,
CBS had a wonderful program from the front called Correspondence Roundup. And Eric Severide would do it, Charlie Collingwood, Winston Burdett, all of your great guys. And they were friendly with me. And since I was the Army correspondent, they put me on. And people began to think, and they still think today, that they heard me as a CBS correspondent during the battles of World War II. Now, in fact, I was an Army correspondent, but I was on CBS. That's true.
Well, after the war, all of the servicemen were anxious to return home, go back to their civilian jobs or get new ones or go back to school on the GI Bill. But you had something different in mind. You decided to stay where?
I stayed in Paris for a good reason, because not only were the servicemen eager to go home, but the great CBS war correspondents, Eric Severide, Charlie Collingwood, they saw big dollars on the horizon back in the USA, and they were right. They began earning a lot of money. And they didn't want to hang around and be a foreign correspondent at a much lower salary. Boy, I was happy to do so because I'd never earned that kind of money anyway, and I didn't care about that. I had originally been a teacher, and I come from an academic family, and I was determined to become the greatest professor of French literature in history. But, of course, I couldn't. My work towards my doctorate degree was interrupted, so I switched and decided I was going to become the greatest foreign correspondent. And since Eric and Charlie were running away, I decided, oh, boy, there's my opening. And I saw Ed Moreau, whom I'd known all through the war. We were fellow correspondents. And I told this to Ed Moreau. When the war ended, Ed called me in, and he said, David, are you going back to teaching? Are you dedicated to it? And I said, well, dedicated's a big word for a guy in his 20s, but sure, I like teaching. And Ed Moreau, bless his sainted soul, said to me, David, I can give you the greatest classroom in the world, CBS News. Bah, I jumped at it.
Yeah, which ultimately he did. During this period, and maybe a little before, there was quite a little literary establishment in Paris that you were involved in, wasn't there?
Oh, my. We had the greatest collection of young and middle-aged talent that has ever been assembled in any one capital at the one time. Among the Americans there was a young kid, a young reporter for Newsweek called Ben Bradley. Ben is now probably one of America's greatest editors, the editor of the Washington Post, the man who supervised the Watergate reporting. There was a pudgy young kid, smoking a cigar all the time, who worked for Variety. His name was Art Buchwald. He's the greatest political satirist in the world. There was another young fellow living in the same building, a good buddy of mine, Theodore H. White. I guess he's written the greatest number of political bestsellers in history. And living on a floor just above them was a young writer named Irwin Shaw. And, of course, we knocked around regularly 2-3 times a week with a writer, not young, but already well-known, but a terrific guy named Papa Ernest Hemingway. And then there was Jimmy Jones. And on the French side, there was Jean-Paul Sartre, the philosopher, and his sidekick, Simone de Beauvoir. There was Albert Camus, one of the greatest writers of the 20th century. Oh, boy, we mixed with the most wonderful, wonderful crowd of people.
That's some heady companionship for a young guy in his 20s.
Oh, it was a constant drunk without alcohol.
James Jones, was he there that early?
No. Jimmy came in the late 1950s. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about the period 1945 to 1960, when almost all of us were around almost all the time.
Well, eventually, you were hired by CBS. I guess you got the word when you were in Prague.
Yes, I was working for a little agency at the time called the Overseas News Agency. It was very distinguished. We sold our service to the New York Times. And I was on a trip through Eastern Europe. I was in Prague with my wife, who was then a couple of months pregnant. I tried to stop her from going, but she said, hey, where you go, I go.
With BookBeat, I'm Don Swain. David Schoenbrunn, the former CBS News correspondent, looks
a wonderful woman. I loved her and love her very dearly. And so we went off to Prague together in February, and it was ice cold. Oh, boy, we got into that hotel room, and they didn't have running water. They had a pan of water on the washstand, and that pan of water was a block of ice. The room was ice cold. We jumped into bed, and they had these wonderful old European eiderdowns, very warm and comfy, and we got into it. And the next morning, about 7 o'clock, somebody yelled, telegram, and slipped the yellow telegram under my door. And my wife said, David, there's a telegram. Go and get it. I said, not on your life. Some stupid editor of mine who, you know, wants a gross of pencils or something from Prague. I wouldn't get out of bed. And the next thing I knew, the cover was off. Blast of icy air hit me as my wife raced to the door. She came in and took her 2 ice-cold feet and put them on my behind, and I screamed in agony, and she tore open the telegram, and I heard her yell, David, David! And I thought, oh, my God, what's happened? My mother's died, her mother's died, you know. And she said, listen to this. And she read this telegram, which is one of the greatest I've ever gotten in my life. If you would like to become the CBS Paris correspondent, call me, collect, soonest, signed, Edward R. Murrow.
Imagine you got out of bed rather quickly.
That room was warm, warm. I got up and I danced around and I rushed downstairs and I called Ed, not knowing that it was 2 o'clock in the morning in New York.
Wake up, Ed. The answer is yes. Well, what year was that?
1947.
1947, didn't have satellites then. You had different ways of communicating back to the States via shortwave. Tell me about the problems you had.
Well, we worked on shortwave radio, and sometimes it was very good, and sometimes there were sunspots, and there was a lot of static. I remember one night I was sitting and watching the Johnny Carson show with my wife, and we got hysterical with laughter when Robert Klein, the comedian, came on, and he said, you know, he says, back in the early days there, he said, I was a school teacher. Klein taught English. And he said, before going to school, I tune in to the 8 a.m. CBS World News Roundup, and I would hear David Schoenbrunn from Paris, and he would say, today in Paris, something very important happened. General de Gaulle, blah, blah, glue, blue, blah, blah, blah. And then General de Gaulle said, blah, blah, goo, goo. And believe me, this is going to be a very serious crisis, blah, blah, boo, boo. And then clear as a bell, this is David Schoenbrunn in Paris, now back to CBS News in New York. And he said he would go to school to teach and worry all day long. What was the crisis that Schoenbrunn was talking about?
You know, it still happens.
Yeah.
Well, they brought you back to the United States to cover a momentous news conference in Abilene. Tell us about that.
Well, that is a very important event in the history of television. You see, I'm a kind of a pioneer in this field. I, being a CBS radio man, was there when television was invented, so I did the first television broadcast. But the first nationally televised political campaign was in 1952. When General Eisenhower came home to run for the presidency. Since I had been on Eisenhower's staff and was a good friend of his, CBS decided to assign me to the Eisenhower train, not plane, train in those days. And I covered Ike, and the very first speech he was supposed to make and his first news conference was in Abilene, Kansas. And Bill Paley himself, Mr. Chairman, sir, called me and announced to me that I was going to be the American pool correspondent. I was going to cover that conference for CBS, NBC, and ABC. This was my first political assignment in the U.S. of A. I was scared stiff.
First TV assignment, too.
First TV assignment in America, sure. And Murrow called me up and say he was going to join me in Abilene. And Murrow came over, and we were playing poker the night before the news conference when Murrow got a phone call from Bill Paley. And he was in, and he called Bill Paley and he said, you know, Jim Hagerty has just announced that television is going to be barred from the Eisenhower News Conference. Now, it's inconceivable today that anybody can imagine television being barred. But we were new and we were weak in those days. We weren't the power that we are today. And Murrow said, what do I do? And Paley said, I'll call you back. Paley had a conference with Goldenson of ABC, Sarnoff of NBC. They called Murrow back, and they said, you tell David Schoenbrunn to walk into that theater. We're going to have a cameraman following him. If there's a police line, David is not to stop. He's to walk through the police line. If the police grab him, he is to be carried out with the cameraman taking pictures of what's happening. Well, that was some first assignment. When I loaded that camera and sound equipment and started to march in, I was terrified, into that theater, and there was a police guard, and they didn't stop me. They broke ranks, and I came in. But then there was a policeman inside, and instead of letting me go to the orchestra with the other reporters, I was moved up to the balcony. I was strictly back of the bus. They argued in those days that television lights would turn the news conference into a circus and destroy the objective atmosphere.
They're right. They still are.
Well, they still argue about it, but they can't argue any longer because now we tell them what time to go on the air and when to begin. It's a different world today. But in those days, we were fighting for television to be recognized. Can you believe that? And I was the guy doing the fighting, the guy in the trenches. So I got into my balcony, and then I turned around to look at my monitor, because when you're broadcasting, you're supposed to see what's going out, and you have earphones so you can hear it, and you know what your audience is hearing. Only they had not brought in my equipment. In all of the excitement of forcing the police line, my engineers had been held out. I was allowed in. I had no monitor. I was blind, and I was deaf. So that when Jim Hagerty started speaking, I didn't know if the audience was hearing him. So I began repeating what Jim Hagerty was saying. Now, what I didn't know is back in 485 Madison Avenue up on the 17th floor, Hubble Robinson, Paul White, all of the big shots of CBS were watching the program, and they were listening. They saw Hagerty talking, but they couldn't hear Hagerty because I was talking over him. And they were screaming, Schoenbrunn, shut up. Somebody jumped up and said, fire that SOB, kill him. My career almost came to an end. And I was innocent, but nobody knew it. Then Eisenhower came out, and boy, lightning struck. And I said, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know whether you're going to hear General Eisenhower, but I don't dare talk over him. I'm going to be quiet. If you hear nothing, please, just be patient. I'll review it for you later. Everybody in 17th floor said, oh, God, thank you, David. My job was saved. And then I later discovered that Eisenhower did get through perfectly, and we won the day, and from then on, there was no holding back television.
No, no. I kind of jumped ahead a little bit, but you have a marvelous anecdote in your book that takes place, I believe it's in Paris, in which Edward R. Murrow threw you a curve. I don't want to leave that one out. Can you tell us about that?
Oh,
remember you were sitting next to...
Yes. It was during the Berlin blockade. And Ed Murrow had flown to Berlin to do a report. Then he came to Paris to do his evening report. He did five-minute pieces on his own show, and Bob Trout did the news in New York. And Ed came in, and I got him a gorgeous suite at the Hotel Crillon. I got him his favorite Chivas scotch. And we sat down, and I watched him belt off one scotch, then I watched him belt off another scotch. And then I said, Ed, it's getting time. I think we better walk over to the studio. He said, oh, sure. So we walked over. It was 10 minutes to airtime. And Ed said to me before we walked into the studio behind the Opera House, is there a decent pub around here, David? I said, Ed, it's, at the studio. He said, I didn't ask you that. And he was my boss, and I loved him and revered him. I said, well, right across the street there, Ed, is the Sintra. He said, well, I'll just go in and have a little nip, and you get up and get the circuits hot. I said, yes, sir. So I went up, and I called New York, and I said, ici Paris, David Schönbrunn, je vous parle de Paris, hello, New York, come in, New York, come in, New York. And we got the circuit going. And with 1 minute to air, in walks Edward R. Murrow in his Savile Row suit, absolutely immaculate, handsome, as not a ripple in his hair, not a script in his hand, and he sits down. I have never admired a man more. 3 shots of scotch, no script, and he's going to do a five-minute show. And Murrow sat down. I watched him with admiration, and Murrow said, good evening. This is Edward R. Murrow in Paris. Last night, you heard me from Berlin. Tomorrow, you'll hear me from London. If I can broadcast to you from each of these capitals, it's because we have the greatest CBS correspondents in each one of them. And I thought to myself, what a doll he is. Now he's giving us a boost, what a boss. And he says, and here in Paris, nobody knows France and what's happening more than my colleague, David Schönbrunn. David? And he throws it to me. Don, you're a radio man. Do you know what that meant? I don't know what I said. I really don't know what I said. As I recall, I had done an interview the day before with the French foreign minister. So I just, rehashed that one, and I told the story. Gave it back to Ed. He got up and marched right out of the studio, and I knew where he went. So I got out after closing the circuit down and went over to the Sintra bar, and there he was. I sat down. I looked at him. I said, Murrow, I thought you were my friend. That was a lousy thing you just did to me. He said, David, I am your friend, and it was not a lousy thing. He said, I'm going to tell you why I did it. I hired you because you knew France, and I know you're a good reporter and a good scholar, but I have no idea what you would do in an emergency. He said, several times during the war, I was broadcasting when a bomb hit near our building and shook the whole building. Remember the day the Hindenburg blew up while somebody was on the air? And I said to myself, what will David Schönbrunn do if something unexpected happens? He said, well, I found out tonight, David, and welcome to the staff.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful stories, David Schönbrunn. Skip ahead. I've so many things to ask that I can't really do justice because you cover half a century of...
And in what book?
What was the name of that book? Nightmare Years, wasn't it? No, it'll get a mention once in a while. You found, to your horror, at one point that you had been declared a security risk.
Yep. I tell the whole story in my book, and it's a very revealing story that I hope Americans will take to heart. It was in Chicago in 52 during the Democratic Convention when Ed Murrow called me into his hotel one night and said, David, you're in big trouble. I said, really? What did I do? He said, I don't know, but you've been declared a security risk by the Pentagon, and you can't get your accreditation card, which means you can't work for us anymore. You got to go to Washington and clear yourself. I said, clear myself of what charges? Murrow said, I don't know. I said, what's going on in this country? And Mara said, it's hell. Joe McCarthy has terrorized this land of ours. We're losing our freedom, David. He said, I've got a lot of clout, but I can't do a damn thing for you. You better get down to Washington and straighten yourself out. Well, my blood turned cold, really turned cold. I went to Washington and I saw General Omar Bradley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the number one man in the Pentagon, and my close friend and war buddy. And I said, Omar, what the hell is this? And Omar said, David, you were cleared by the Army, you were cleared by the Navy, you were cleared by the Air Force, by the Marines, but the Air Force security man wouldn't clear you. I said, why don't you just overrule him? You're the boss. He said, David, I can't do that. He said, go down and see this guy. So I went and saw this general, and I said, what am I charged with? He said, I have nothing to say to you. I make my own decisions, and I've got nothing to explain, and I have nothing to say to you. Get out of my office. I staggered out, absolutely staggered. I just didn't know where to turn. I went home, and I called an old and dear friend, Morris Ernst, the lawyer, excuse me, who was head of the American Civil Liberties Union. He was also a friend of J. Edgar Hoover and of Lou Nichols, the number two man in the FBI. Excuse me, and he said, Lou, can David come down and speak to you and find out what this is all about? And Lou Nichols said, sure. So I went down, and Lou Nichols said, David, I know you, I like you, and I know that you're a good and loyal American, but I think the first thing you better do is go in a little empty room there. I'm going to show you your FBI file, let you read it. Well, I sat and read that file, and I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. There were anonymous letters in the file calling me a communist. I was called a secret agent of the Jews and a secret agent of the Arabs. That's pretty good if you can be both of those. You know, I found one unbelievable report from an FBI agent who had checked my apartment house for 1 week and discovered that 21 men had visited my apartment and only two of them wore hats. And I said, what does that mean? Oh, he says, all good Americans wear hats and communists go without a hat. I said, you got to be kidding. He said, no, I'm not kidding. This is the sort of garbage that's in this file. I said, don't you guys evaluate the file? He said, no, we just let it sit there. I said, what happened then? Well, he said, the Pentagon asked for your file. We sent it over. The Army dismissed it. The Marines dismissed it. The Navy dismissed it. But the Air Force took it seriously. I said, Lou, what do I do about this? He said, I'll tell you what, David. You go home and write an ode to yourself about what a great American you are. Give us the names of all your friends. Averill Harriman, David Bruce. I said, how about President Eisenhower? Oh, he said, yeah, that's a good name. It's a good recommendation. He said, put it all in. So the next time your file is called for, they can see your version of who you are. And I said, well, that's the most awful thing I've ever heard. Do I have to go on my hands and knees and beg people to believe that I'm a good American? I was in military intelligence. I was a soldier for 3 years. I was on Eisenhower's day. He said, David, don't sing me your song. I know it so well, and I'm sick to heart about this, but that's what you have to do. Well, I did it. It didn't make the slightest bit of difference. But my career was saved by one of the best newsmen and one of the bravest Americans I've ever known, Clayton Fritchie, former editor of the Louisville Courier Journal, a great American newspaper. Clay was working for the Defense Department at the time, and General Marshall, Secretary of Defense, called him in one day and said, Clay, there's a bunch of Americans here who've been called security risks. We've checked them out. They're good men. But I can't sign it because I'll get into a hassle with Joe McCarthy and company, and I don't want to endanger the office of the Defense Department. He said, I don't care about myself. He said, I've got to find somebody who can take the risk. And you are a bachelor. You're from a good family. You've got money. You can risk it. Will you do it? Clayton Fritchie said, hand me those cards. And Clayton Fritchie signed my card, issued it, and nobody challenged him, and I was back in business.
So you're clear to this day, are you?
Well, you
are. Yes. Did you, by yes, chance, indeed. Read a book by Penn Kimball called The File?
It's yep.
Very similar to yep. What you had to go through,
yep.
Only his dragged on year. He still hasn't cleared his name.
No. Well, I was one of the few guys who could see his file, and I had enough contacts and connections, and I was, you know, so completely innocent, there was no question about it, that it was cleared very rapidly. But a lot of other people, equally innocent, I'm quite sure, have had their careers and their lives ruined.
Well, David Schoenbrunn, you went on to have a very distinguished career. You covered the French War in Vietnam. You became the chief Washington correspondent for CBS News. You had some problems, however, in dealing with the powers that were for CBS News during this period. I don't know how much you would like to discuss them on the air, although you go into great detail in your book, but I guess you ran across a lot of the same bureaucratic problems that we have today at CBS and the other places.
Oh, I can make it simple. It was a very simple problem. I had a wonderful job. Not only was I Washington correspondent, but I did the news analysis on the Walter Cronkite Evening News Show. I was very happy. But one thing was missing. I wanted my own platform, my own show, even a small one. David Brinkley had his own program. Howard K. Smith had his own program. I wanted mine, too, to say what I wanted to say when I wanted to say it, and to be scheduled at a regular time so people could tune in. Now, if they watched the Cronkite Show every night, they'd see me 2-3 times a week. But nobody knew when I was ever going to be on the Cronkite Show. It wasn't scheduled, and I wanted my name in the paper so that my friends and fans could find me. CBS finally gave me a program of my own, and they tried to bury me in what was known as the Sunday morning ghetto, intellectual ghetto. They gave me a show at 12 o'clock. To their astonishment, my program became instantly very successful. One reason is, on my very first program, I did an exclusive interview with President John F. Kennedy. And I'm a pretty good reporter, and I was breaking stories right and left. And that's where the trouble started. One day there was a Franco-American crisis. I knew all the French. I called the French ambassador, Hervé Alphand, a close friend of mine, invited him on my program. The next morning, Don Hewitt, now the great chief of 60 Minutes, then the director of and producer of the Cronkite News, called me up and said, David, we just called the French ambassador. We want him to be on Walter's show. And he told me that he had already told you that he's going to be on your show. So would you please call him up and cancel him out and put him back on my show? I said, no, Don, I won't do that. Don said, hey, wait a minute, David. You know, you're working for CBS, and we call The Turn, and the Cronkite Evening News program is our most important program. Yours is not. I said, I know that perfectly well, Don. And if you had called me first instead of calling the French ambassador and asked me to get him, I would have gotten him for you. But when you go over the head of your own Washington correspondent and ask a man, and then you want to humiliate me by having me call him up and cancel him out of my program, you will have destroyed my effectiveness in Washington. I'm no Walter Cronkite, but I am a dignified man in my own name, and I will not be trampled upon. I said, I know your problem, but the answer is no. Well, we had fights like this, and finally what happened is they came to me one day, Walter Cronkite, Don Hewitt, Ernest Leiser, the three of them, big men from New York, came down and visited me in Washington and said, we have good news, David. I was instantly suspicious because good news is translated over the telephone. I don't need three heavy wheels, a Walter Cronkite, a Don Hewitt, to come to Washington. I said, what's the good news? Well, they said, and by the way, the audience won't believe that, but in those days in the 1960s, the evening news show was 15 minutes long. With commercials, that meant about 12 minutes long. They said, we're going to a half hour. I said, great, wonderful news. And David, you're going to be the chief commentator of the program. You're getting a whopping big raise in salary. And I said, that's marvelous. And I waited for the second shoe to drop. And it did. They said, in order to increase our evening program, we have to take time back from other programs and give it back to the program department. And your Sunday show is hereby canceled. Well, that's why I left CBS.
Well, you served a stint briefly in Europe for CBS.
Yeah, they begged me to go to Europe. Frank Stanton, I must say, called me in and begged me to, and he was on the president of CBS, and he said, David, these guys were giving you trouble. Don't worry about it. I'll work it out. He was so generous. He said, David, go on full salary, full expense account. Don't even broadcast. Write your book on General de Gaulle. I said, no, Frank. I'm not going to be a bird in a gilded cage with a hood over my head. I can't do that. Oh, he said, give it a try. So I did. I went back to Europe. They promised me a program called the Atlantic Communications, and they never gave it to me. And I was fighting with them every day, and I figured, the hell with it. I had I'd lived through the golden years. I had a wonderful career. I'm not just a broadcaster. I'm also a writer. I've written 30 articles for the New York Times, for Life magazine, Collier's, Saturday Evening Post. You know, I didn't have to take this kind of junk from these news bureaucrats. And I said, no, I'm going to quit. I'll go off on my own. And everybody told me I was crazy. Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg flew home for a vacation, begged me not to leave, and everybody except my wife. My wife said, David, you're miserable, you're unhappy, and you're a good man, and I want you to be happy and do what you want to do. I left CBS with great regret because I love CBS. But on the other hand, I had to because they wouldn't let me do what I wanted to do. I'm not blaming them. The Cronkite News program was their biggest program. Maybe I had a little bit of a swelled head. I just wanted a little place in the sun of my own. But there is no little place in the sun. There's the big fellow, and you work for him or you don't work. And I said, fine, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go off on my own, and I'm going to become Mr. David Schoenbrunn instead of CBS. Let me tell you quickly a very funny story about the difference between America and France. When I left, all my friends came and begged me, and they all said to me and to my wife, what's going to happen to David without CBS? We were furious, as though I'm nothing and that the CBS logo is the only thing I've got. Then we go back to France. Do you know what happened? Everybody in Paris came running over and said, I hear you're leaving CBS. I said, yes. And they said, what's going to happen to CBS without David Schoenbrunn? Well, CBS survived. So did David Schoenbrunn.
And he went on not only to survive, but to produce a number of important books, including America Inside Out. We've talked for almost 40 minutes now, and I could go on and on. There's so many funny things that I've not going to ask you to repeat because I just won't get on. But one thing that I just love was the story about the Paris taxi driver who refused to stop at red lights. Don't tell us.
They're going to have to
find out by reading the book.
They're going to have to buy the book to find out. The night that Ho Chi Minh came to dinner.
Oh, there's wonderful stories. And David Schoenbrunn, thank you very much for coming and spending some time with me and telling me about America.
Let me say it's a delight to be back to CBS. There's no bitterness in me. I've had a very good life. CBS is a wonderful network, still number one, and it's a joy to be back in the family.
Thank you.